Welcome to In Conversation, the regular podcast of Encompass. Go to encompass-europe.com for free access to all our podcasts to date. This is Paul Adamson, and I'm in conversation with Jeff Mead. Jeff Mead spent his entire journalistic career for 4 decades in the Press Association, finishing as Europe editor when he retired about five years ago. But he's also known in Brussels, of course, as the creative genius behind the annual Press Review. He's a humorist and comic writer and performer. So I'm delighted to have you on the podcast, Jeff. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Paul.
Well, we're going to try and make this podcast, you know, introduce a bit of levity maybe into a discussion maybe, which some might think is maybe not appropriate, but I think we should try and finish the year with a bit of a smile on our faces. And 2020, for obvious reasons, has been a hell of a year for everybody, with that exception. But let's try and just look back and look forward a bit as well from our perspective and try and see maybe a slightly funnier side of world affairs. Even though it may seem a bit parochial to a non-British audience, I think we should start ease ourselves in this conversation by talking about Boris Johnson. He's an old journalistic friend of yours from the 80s and 90s, so you know him pretty well as well. As we all know, he wanted to be king of the world. He got to be British Prime Minister. So a year on since the general election in the UK this time last year, how do you rate him as a Prime Minister and also as a performer?
It's really hard because it's so easy to say that everything's been chaotic and a disaster. Let's say for a start, what fair people will always say this about Boris Johnson: no one could wish the unforeseen pandemic upon anyone leading a country. So it's an impossible situation. But I think we can't escape from the fact that a lot of the decision making, or what Boris would call lack of decision making, has been quite disastrous, if not in actual fact, in terms of the spread and scale of the pandemic, then certainly in perception. And perception, of course, in politics is all. So I just think I can't think of any worse luck than to become to get your dream job, to be faced with a pandemic, having already triggered, quite wrongly, some of us believe, an escape clause from the European Union. And the two things clash. Suddenly, here we are. I mean, there was some poetic inevitability about the two things coming together. And they came together, I think it was only yesterday, when I think Gavin Williamson on British newscast tried to make a positive point about the fact that when France shut down the borders because of this new mutant strain of the virus, at least Britain was ready because of its preparations for a disastrous Brexit. So I thought this was wonderful. Oh yes, that's cheered me up. The fact that they had to implement a strategy for what would inevitably be a disastrous situation at the Channel ports for Brexit, lo and behold, we've been able to test it early, thanks to a disastrous development in the pandemic. I mean, you could not make it up. I mean, whatever happens to Boris's career as a politician, I'm sure the book of his time as Prime Minister will be absolutely unputdownable. In the meantime, though, I think, poor guy, you watch him. I mean, he's worn out. It's an incredibly difficult situation to be in. But he does have this wonderful habit of trying to talk his way out of things, even when he knows he's being accused. I think yesterday he was accused by a journalist in his latest TV press statement. He said, why do you always talk things up and then let us down? And in replying, he said, obviously he didn't really address the point, but he said, well, we just try to give you the truth. And I'm sure that by Easter we'll be out of this mess.
But as a humorist and a keen observer of people's behavior, do you feel that even now, certainly in the first few months of his prime ministership, he's had to kind of suppress a natural tendency to be funny and to crack a joke and to have a little smirk on his face? Is he learning on the job how to be serious and solemn?
Well, I mean, I think this is a plus point when I say he finds it difficult to be too serious about anything. But there is a time and a place. And if there was ever a time when I would say turn off the comedic charm, it's now. I mean, again, even yesterday or the day before on television, in addressing the latest crisis, because that's what it is with the pandemic and the closure of ports and everything, he was, anyone who doesn't know him would say, he's grinning while he speaks. Yeah. Now, my wife and I were talking about this as we watched, and I said, look, I don't think he knows, he's not grinning really, but he just has that slight tendency towards a smirk, and it can be misinterpreted, and it looks so out of place. But he is prone to, there are two traits really. He's prone, of course, to say, well, everything will be fine. I mean, just will. I mean, that's the Boris shtick. And I applaud that as a general principle of life, but perhaps not in the job he's holding. So there's that tendency to talk everything up, and the inability to be too serious. The only times we've seen him serious is when he is forced to say, I'm locking down, I'm changing my mind. And he does, and I'm sure he's sincere when he says, you've no idea how this, how reluctant I am to tell you what I'm about to tell you. Right. But he is his own worst enemy, because I think I'm prone to do the same thing. Oh, everything will be fine. But then I'm not prime minister.
Well, you touched on the looming Brexit end of year transition story. Another deadline that's come and gone. They seem to be daily now, deadlines. And you know what deadlines are, being a journalist for 4 decades or more. Do you think that Boris, as a former journalist, kind of approaches this job like a journalistic deadline? It's not actually, the copy is not due just yet, so let's push it back until the very last minute. Do you think that back of his mind he has an old journalistic reflex?
I don't know how much you say that sort of flippantly, but I think it's entirely true. I genuinely do. I watch Boris and I think, and I mean, people who don't know how journalists operate or don't know Boris probably think this is ridiculous. That's a cheap shot. But it's true. What we're seeing is a journalist applying journalistic standards to a political top job. It's classic Boris, it's classic me, it's classic most journalists, leave it till the last minute.
Right.
I mean, I know that political negotiations often go down to the wire, and we understand that that's almost how politics must work sometimes. You don't, it's not over till it's over. But to let this go to this point, still with them, I'm sure when Boris puts on his pajamas and goes to bed at night, he's thinking, oh, it'll be all right tomorrow. And I think in that sense, to make a serious point, I think he's proved himself totally unsuited to the job he's got. But we can see why he got the job.
Yeah.
There is a Trump connection there. It just appeals, the headline grabbing style. But when you come down to pandemics and trying to get a Brexit deal, it's just the biggest car crash.
Well, as a segue then into the maybe a less parochial, more EU part of this little chat we're having, you wrote a fabulous piece for Encompass recently where you imagine you're kind of fly on the wall at the dinner that Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen had a couple of weeks ago now. And at one point you say, as if you were there watching, you say, and I quote, "Ursula shook her head as she prodded an English scallop of Italian and Greek parentage, which until very recently had been minding its own business, swimming in a borderless sea off Ostend, until fate steered it towards a German-owned French trawler with a Romanian crew." That is, Jeff Mead, that's pure. That's one of your best sentences ever, I would suggest. Well done.
That's very kind.
Well, do you imagine that was the kind of the conversation they were having? It was quite a difficult conversation, the two of them.
Well, I can't see Boris turning off the mechanism that we've just discussed, i.e. the desire to be flippant. And particularly, even with Ursula von der Leyen, in a private meeting, I'm sure he will have tried to lighten the mood, even though there's no, it's not appropriate. I just think that's how he is. That's how he's always been. Right. And you can see why he does it, because thus far, or at least until 2 or 3 years ago, it got him everywhere. Look at him. You look at his CV. It's triumphant. But there are some things you can't grin your way out of, I'm afraid. And yeah. I think it's caught his own personality is caught up with him.
What's your kind of verdict or assessment of how the EU, especially institutions in Brussels, have performed and even survived in this year of COVID? I mean, it's obviously for everybody the year of the Zoom call and no more face-to-face meetings, but is that maybe going to, whenever you get around to writing sketches and performing the press review if it comes back, is that great and fertile ground for funny writing, the fact that everybody now is reduced to making Zoom calls?
I think it is. So what's been interesting is if you look behind it, the year of you know, the pandemics, virtually the whole year, we have an income at that time. We had a new president of the European Commission, and of course, she desperately wants to get on with the normal daily business of the European Union. So regularly, one has seen new plans, new strategies, new programs, new ideas. The Future of Europe conference, for instance, a climate change, new deadlines for being climate change friendly. Yeah. All these things are going on in the background, but of course, no one's really paying attention to them. That's probably totally unfair. I'm sure within the institutions they are, but you've watched the stuff of European life going on in the European Parliament and everything else. But of course, the shadow of the pandemic hangs over everything. And I just observe as the months go by, oh yes, there's another new commission initiative, a policy idea. It's going to the council, that MEPs will vote on it. But of course, they're not landing anywhere.
Yeah.
Of course, some have had to be postponed for good reasons. But I mean, I do get the impression, I don't know if you do, that the pandemic forcing the shutdown of offices has not materially affected the commission's work programme.
No.
I mean, yes, one or two things are delayed. The Future of Europe conference, for instance, is a big one. But talking to people I know within the institutions at all sorts of levels, I think working from home has actually been quite effective. People are doing their jobs. And the people I have talked to, volunteer information, said, no, I'm working as hard as ever. I'm doing it from home. But we're still having to do the stuff.
Yeah, we'll come to future conference issue in a wee second. But before we do, when it comes to the commission themselves, the top people at the commission, as opposed to the civil servants down the food chain, do you think there's also a problem for them of kind of visibility and link to that recognizability? It's quite a new commission. It's only a year old in effect, and most of the commissioners were not in the previous commission. Obviously, notable exceptions like Margrethe Vestager and Frans Timmermans and a few others. But and so their public profile is not as high maybe as their predecessors.
I think that's right. Yes, I think for most people, virtually none of the commissioners are figures, public figures as they might have been before, with one, of course, notable exception. I mean, everybody, certainly even in the now departed United Kingdom, knows the name of Michel Barnier, legendary. But I think that's right. But the thing is, of course, we all know they're getting on with what they do.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that the most, you say, maybe the most visible personality is not even a commissioner, Michel Barnier. Right, let's moving on to the Future of Europe conference. So this sounds like a brand new spanking idea. Is it a brand new spanking idea?
Well, no. If you under previous commission administrations, there have been efforts to forge a new path. And what strikes me is there is this worthy, but I think almost impossible to enact, desire to engage every single citizen. We've under the presidency of Barroso a few years ago, there were lots of efforts, lots of town hall meetings, as the Americans would call them. I think in total there were 51 individual regional gatherings of venerable EU citizens to talk about this. And that's worthy, and I wouldn't attack it at all. I just think it's slightly pie in the sky. The minute you want to look at the future of Europe, as Ursula von der Leyen is intent on doing again, and come up with new initiatives, of course they want to be seen to engaging with the public. But I think it's a bit of a folly to assume that you can engage. I mean, there's a former British Labour MP, Roger Casales, who runs New Europeans, which he formed in about 2013, I think, and he was recently quoted as saying there are ways, even during pandemic shutdown, to engage. Let's get this Future of Europe conference that von der Leyen has promised off the ground. Let's talk about stuff now, and we can do it partly online, partly with small face-to-face gatherings of people. But he's the one who's saying technology would now allow communication directly with 466 million EU citizens. And I think Mr. Casales obviously is not a man who's tried to hold an eight-way Zoom conference with his family. I mean, I know that's not exactly what he means. But I think because of a lot of negative reaction to the European Union, not just from the UK, certainly since they tried to introduce a sort of new constitution, as it were, and it was voted down by the Dutch and the French, alarmingly.
Mm.
Everyone's very sensitive to make sure that, oh yes, we're talking to citizens.
Yeah.
But just as the bulk of the British electorate was not really qualified to vote on Brexit, in my view,
mm.
I think it's wrong to say, well, we're listen to the public, but don't assume that's the be all and end all.
The trouble, if you follow that logic, which I totally probably subscribe to as well, Jeff, is that most people, yes, apart from technology breaking down, it's also people have lives to lead. They have, you know, bills to pay. They're not going to maybe spend hours writing a submission about the future of Europe, which then means we kind of go back to a kind of classic fallback, you know, where the kind of self-styled connoscenti, the think tank, you will, some academics and some NGOs, civil society groups who spend all their time doing this kind of stuff, they occupy all that space and not maybe necessarily bringing that so many new ideas into the mix. It certainly remains a kind of specialist topic, the EU, for specialists.
Well, yeah, and I think it bogs down the process. If you're saying, we'll hear the public, then we'll talk about it, we'll consult them again for follow-up and things like that. No, the other way around. The professional politicians and European experts,
yeah,
come up with what you think. Can you imagine if someone said, well, I'm the new prime minister of whatever country or president, I'm going to ask all citizens to give me their input into what I do about road transport or something. Well, of course, as you say, there are already lobby groups, there are expert organisations who are consulted. Mm. So I right now, in fact, as we speak, I think the Future of Europe conference, of course, has been delayed. I think it was supposed to have a launch in March, April, of course, quite the wrong time. But right now, it seems that the current talking point is who should be the chairman of this thing. Well, of course, this is institutional life around the world. We all know. So I'm not having to go to the EU, but that's where we are. Well, get that sorted and then worry about consulting the electorate.
But it was originally Emmanuel Macron idea, I think, wasn't it? The idea was to launch it, you know, now, maybe even during the German presidency and then spend 2 years and then conclude during the French presidency in 2022. So I think it did, to be fair to Mrs. van der Leyen, she's maybe picking up an assignment, some homework that Emmanuel Macron gave her to do.
Well, and yes, and I think that's another thing. In a club of the 27, I can see the attraction for certain leaders to say, well, if I play my cards right on this new initiative, which runs over a couple of years or more, maybe it will land in my basket when I have the rotating presidency of the EU for 6 months, or I want to be, my country should be the one that launches this or produces results. I think that's, and again, it's not really a criticism of the EU, it's a criticism of political egotism everywhere in the world. But right. you do fall foul of that sort of thing. At what point do I want to engage? I want to be seen, you know, I'm sure for von der Leyen, it's already in her head something of a legacy thing. Now, there's nothing wrong with being driven by some form of ego to do something. That's the way, you know, democracy works in a way. Or what will the public want to see me do? But of course, legacy has had to take a back seat in Europe for the time being. But I just think, these people in Brussels, in the institutions, come up with some ideas. Let the public knock them down and then worry about it.
That's a very good point. Well, let's move then. Let's finish off this little chat by looking ahead. As I said at the beginning, it's been a grim year for everybody this year. But will 2021 be as grim? I ask the question because it puts you in a kind of certain mindset. If you were to be writing material for your next press review, would there be enough, do you think, material to of a humorous nature to work with, or would it be quite tough to find a lighthearted side of things?
I don't think it will be that tough because, frankly, the day-to-day business of the political institutions provide the material. It's not a question of looking for things to be rude about particularly. It's just the kind of humour that certainly British listeners will remember from that famous political show. Remind me what it is. You know the one I'm going to talk about. Yes, Minister.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, brain's going at my age. But, you know, it's not to do with with looking for things to pick up about the EU. It's more to, about the way politics works. And it is yes, minister plus Europe kind of thing. It's that sort of thing. So often I find, you know, interest in a comedic way in things like the Future of Europe conference, imagining, well, what could be the most silly thing that you could create for the future of Europe? So I think have agreed more or less, there's not a lot to laugh about the Brexit right now, certainly less than ever, given the situation we're in as we run up to Christmas. But the stuff of European life is going on, and that's where the humour lies. And I always emphasise, just as it would in British politics or French politics, it's not that the EU is inherently more funny than anyone else. It's the stuff of political engagement, one-upmanship, one institution wanting to outdo the other. It's been here since democracy was born. And as I say, when people say, oh, why do you British find the EU so amusing? I said, well, can I refer you back to a wonderful series in the 1970s called Yes, Minister? And you'll find that we British were taking the mickey out of political institutional life purely in the House of Commons. It's not to do with, well, it is for some people, but it's not largely to do with attacking or making mockery of the European Union as a set of institutions. Institutional life is funny.
No, I think people know that. So, well, as a final thought from me, my friend, I look forward to the show whenever it takes place, rather if it takes place, because I want you to see your impersonation of Charles Michel, because you and Mr. Michel have at least one thing in common, is that you both occasionally wear roll neck sweaters under a suit. So that's half the task done. So you've got a few months to grow a beard, and then it's done and sorted. We have to leave it there. Jeff Mead, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.